Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Computer. Replay first archive file. Hosts log, star date 10 March 2020, point 7.
Dr. Blair? Do you fancy watching some Star Trek The Next Generation with me? I watched bits of it when I was a kid, but I think I missed the first few entire seasons. And I just watched that two-parter. It's called Encounter at Farpoint, the one that opens the first season. I watched it yesterday, and it is, you know, it's ropey, but these early episodes, it might be fun.
I'll try. I've never been into Star Trek, though. You watch it, and I'll sit with you and do my nails or something. Hosts log, star date 15 January 2022.2. And there's a fourth season of Discovery to get started on, plus we haven't even started on Picard. There's a 10 episode season of that, and I'm dying to see what they've done with 7 of 9. Oh, and I haven't even told you about Prodigy yet.
Hey, I've just worked out how many episodes of Star Trek we've managed to watch so far across, I think it's 6 separate seasons now?
No, hold on. We have to fill in those short tracks we haven't even seen, and apparently Lower Decks is amazing and hilarious, and there's 20 episodes of that already. Hello and welcome to Audiovisual Cultures, the podcast that boldly goes to the galactic edges of media, arts and culture. Stop laughing at me. I'm Paula Blair, and do I have a surprise for you? Newer listeners may not know this, but I used to have a co-host for this show. Established listeners, please join me in welcoming back Dr. Andrew Scheel. Woohoo! Scheel, would you like to have a go at explaining what we're going to talk about today?
We are going to talk about enough content to constitute over 51,000 articles on Memory Alpha, the Star Trek wiki. Or at least we're going to scratch the surface of that, because even though we have watched 696 episodes of Star Trek across 6 series...
Yes, we have used this pandemic time well.
We have not finished watching all of the Star Trek, and we never will. I worked out that if we'd done this back, if the world had organised itself better and had a pandemic back in about 2016, we would have watched all of the Star Trek, and that would have been it. We would have gone tick, Star Trek done. But since what known as the Alex Kurtzman era, since he took over as showrunner of Discovery, Star Trek's gone crazy recently. So although we have now watched 3 seasons of Discovery on top of 7 seasons of Star Trek The Next Generation, 7 seasons of Deep Space Nine, 7 seasons of Voyager, 4 seasons of Enterprise, and a season and a bit of the original series.
Four of the movies.
And some of the films, yeah. Even though we've done that, and of course in completely the wrong order, there's still a mountain of Star Trek yet to watch.
And it's being made. Strange New Worlds is very exciting. I love what's happening with Pike. It's a very important character. So there is no point in trying to go into too much detail. There's going to be loads of stuff we're going to leave out. So I think very quickly, some honourable mentions to amazing music. Scores throughout are just usually really awesome. So we'll see if we can circle back to that anytime. So many incredible actors, directors, all areas of production, just really awesome. There's so many recurring actors who aren't part of main casts, but we keep recognising and they keep coming back. And the beauty about aliens and heavy prosthetic makeup is that lots of people get to come back across lots of different series, which is really fun. So many big questions, so much to get into about the Mirror Universe, which it might be my favourite thing ever. Love it. I love everybody being badasses. There's just so much to do. So I don't know if we can hope to do much justice, but I just think we've really wanted to sit and chat about this journey that we've been on together without really leaving the house while we've been confined. But I suppose it'd be nice to say, because it's by the time this will probably come out, it'll be a solid year and a half since you've been on the show, and you pretty much started this podcast with me. Any words about why that's been the case?
I'm sure that we could foster many rumours here about schisms that have formed between you and I. And I'm sure, in fact, I'm sure your many listeners have been coming up with their own fantasies about what's happened between you and I. But I have simply been watching a lot of Star Trek with you, initially sitting next to me and then increasingly going,
ooh,
where has this been all my life?
Yeah.
And the watching has taken over from the sitting down and talking about it. You and I used to go and see a film, we'd come out of the film and we'd talk about it for 2 hours and that would be it. But of course, Star Trek will never be finished.
Yes.
Therefore, we'll never do that unless we just at some point rip the plaster off quite painfully and go, right, we'll now talk about just the 696 episodes that we have watched. I know it's not ambitious at all to talk about that many episodes, but we'll get those done and we'll do another one about the remaining, it's at least 60 episodes that we haven't watched.
Mm.
Because, of course, deplorably, we haven't watched the animated series from 1973 to 1974.
Yeah.
Although I do remember bits of it when I was a kid. And, of course, in addition, I have been helping my employer replan its teaching to ever so slightly accommodate to a pandemic. That's taken up a little bit of my time as well. It's also been quite fun to sit back and watch you go and make friends amongst the various humans you can make contact with via the internet these days.
Mm-hmm.
Your free show. It's fun just to hand on the baton of other people producing your free content for free. So tell me, how much do you make your patrons give?
Rule of acquisition number 286. If giving away a podcast for free, never ask patrons for a specific amount of Gold Press Latinum.
We've got a few preliminaries we need to establish in this podcast, which I think might be a little bit longer. This particular episode of Audiovisual Cultures might be a little bit longer.
I guess so.
Than the other ones. Right, so this is the way that Star Trek works. You got the series that was just called Star Trek, which is, of course, now known as Star Trek, the original series, that aired between September 1966 and June 1969. That was 79 episodes across 3 seasons. You got Star Trek, the animated series, September 1973 to October 1974, which was 22 episodes across 2 seasons. You got Star Trek The Next Generation between September 1987 and May 1994. That was 178 episodes across 7 seasons, with 26 episodes in every season except for season 2, which had 22 episodes. And we don't talk about season 2, do we? No, we will talk about season 2. And then starting partway through the run of Star Trek The Next Generation, which we will call TNG, we got Star Trek Deep Space Nine, which ran from January 1993 to June 1999. Almost exactly the same as TNG. It had 176 episodes across 7 seasons. So they duplicated this pattern of we're going to do 7 seasons and then we'll just stop. We won't try and go on forever. Then you got Star Trek Voyager, which started in January 1995, again partway through Deep Space Nine. That ran until May 2001. That had 172 episodes across 7 seasons. Again, 26 episodes in every season, except for season 1 in that case, which had just 16. Then Star Trek Enterprise from the 26th of September 2001 to the 13th of May 2005, comprising 98 episodes across 4 seasons, with 26 episodes in season 1, 26 in season 2. You see the pattern being established here. 24 in season 3 and 22 in season 4, and that was it. And season 4 wraps up very quickly because clearly it had been cancelled by that point, which had a lot to do with it having debuted in September 2001.
A lot of knock-on effects from that. It was very unfortunately timed, I think. I felt really sorry for Enterprise. I think they deserved a lot more. There was some really excellent storytelling and it was just the world went into a very dark place and television became very dark and it just had no truck with these explorers going off optimistically, making new friends.
I'm actually partly convinced that if they just had a different theme tune, the whole success of the show would have been different.
Possibly.
So, yeah, kind of perfect. Perfect evil storm of anti-storm of what was...
But we'll get into that in
and
a bit.
To be extremely precise, it wasn't called Star Trek Enterprise until episode 3.3.
Right.
Up until then, it was just called Enterprise. The relationship to Star Trek was quite arm's length initially. Then Star Trek Discovery, which started running on the 24th of September 2017. We've just had three entire seasons. Season four has started on the in November 2021, so we're partway through season four.
Well, that was the one where we had started to watch it on Netflix, and then it just wasn't there.
The thing happened.
And then we find out what happened. It had just been taken off everything ahead of it airing on Paramount Plus, I think.
Yeah.
In November. And so we were left stranded in the Mirror Universe in season one. It was very rude.
I actually had to buy DVDs, which it felt very pleasant and nostalgic. Yeah. So Star Trek Discovery, ongoing. It's accompanied by a short season of Short Treks, which I'm not counting as episodes, between 2018 and 2020. Those seem to have stopped now.
Yeah.
So I'm sure your listeners will correct that one. You got Star Trek Picard, which started in January 2020, has now had 10 episodes in its first season, and a second season set to premiere in about a month. Star Trek Lower Decks, which started on 6th of August 2020, and has had so far two episodes across two 10-episode seasons. Star Trek Prodigy, which started in October 2021 and is partway through its first 10-episode season. And Star Trek Strange New Worlds is scheduled to launch in the middle of 2022. And about that, we are most excited, aren't we? Given that it was set up in season two of Discovery. Mm-hmm. Right, so that is what Star Trek is. And of that, we've watched a season and a bit of the original series, none of the animated series, all of TNG, all of Deep Space Nine, which of course we call DS9, all of Voyager, all of Enterprise, the first three seasons of Discovery, and that's it. That's our 696 episodes across six series. And then movie-wise, you got Star Trek the Motion Picture in 1979, Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan in 1982, and this two, it's not a thing that's been added by fans, you know, this numbering was on the posters, this is the name of the film, so the numbering applies for a bit. So Star Trek III, The Search for Spock, 1984, Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, 1986, Star Trek V, The Final Frontier, 1989, Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, 1991, Star Trek Generations, the numbering has disappeared, 1994. Star Trek First Contact, 1996, which we adore.
If you were any other man, I would give you where you stand.
Star Trek Insurrection in 1998.
I quite enjoyed that one. People don't like it, but I thought, because it's just a long episode, and I really just enjoyed it, and Data got to do fun stuff in that. Anyway.
Face stretching. That's what I mostly remember from that. The idea of having one's face being stretched could kill you. It wouldn't just really hurt and mutilate you, it would kill you. Yeah. Star Trek Nemesis in 2002.
Bit Tom Hardy.
Wee tiny Tom Hardy.
Yeah, really young Tom Hardy.
And that's it for the films in that timeline, because 2009, a film called Star Trek, J.J. Abrams' Star Trek, started what's known as the Kelvin timeline, and that's a parallel universe reboot. So it's not a reboot in the sense of, right, everyone forget that all that original stuff happened, as Spider-Man has repeatedly done during our lifetimes. No, Star Trek does reboots properly. It goes, someone's going to go back in time and create a parallel universe, a forked universe phenomenon.
For which there is precedent in the shows.
We're going to get on to forking universes later.
Because parallels per morph in TNG.
And there have been successive films in that franchise. Well, the franchise is still the same franchise, but in that element of the franchise, the Kelvin timeline, including Star Trek Into Darkness in 2013 and Star Trek Beyond in 2016. Mm-hmm. I am expecting more films. One thing I have to get down right off the bat is that we have, out of these films, we've actually not watched very many together, have we? We've watched Generations, First Contact, Insurrection and Nemesis.
The four TNG ones we've seen together.
But we haven't sat down together and watched the original series films.
I think as a child I might have seen the fourth one. That's the only one I have any vague memories of. More just because of the wheel and that they're in the 20th century.
Yeah.
That's all I remember about it.
And I think we're waiting to finish watching the original series.
Yeah.
No. And then we'll watch those.
And then we'll have watched something in order for a change. Yes.
totally the wrong order. And then we'll get onto the Kelvin timeline ones, because, of course, even though the Kelvin timeline films technically don't have any bearing on anything that we've watched, they do establish two quite big elements of what we have watched, which is that they establish cinematography that characterizes everything made after 2009, including all of the damn camera movement. Cameras being upside down, just cameras constantly floating around. All the lens flare as well. There's so much lens flare in Discovery, even though it's not supposed to happen in the same universe as the Kelvin timeline films, the J.J. Abrams films. It nonetheless, it uses that same style as if it does. And also, the Kelvin timeline films, they establish the look of all of the species.
Yeah.
Even though it takes a big steaming dump all over some retconning that was done during Enterprise about what Klingons are supposed to look like.
Yeah.
So we will get on to all of this. We've watched some telly and we've watched some movies. your question, what have we done in the past couple of years? We've watched some telly and we've watched some movies.
We've done other stuff too, I swear. But
quite adventurously.
I suppose that in a way it has kept us somewhat sane during these very challenging times over the past couple of years. This has not been an experience that's been easy really for most people. And like most people, we've had our challenges during this past couple of years. You know, we've had losses, we've had major separations from our families. You know, we've got to see your family a bit, but I haven't seen mine for over 2 years. You know, so there's been a lot to just, it feels, especially with the TNG era, which is, when I say era, I mean TNG, DS9 and Voyager, because they're all, you know, chronologically coherent. So I mean the three of them, they all begin to feel like family, and you become very emotionally invested in the characters. So I think that's where that has felt actually important to watch over this time. And I know that there's a lot of established Trekkies out there who have been doing a lot of rewatching of these series as well, because they're so comforting, I think.
We are going to do something very sensitive, probably after a short break, where we're going to rank the captains.
Oh, are we?
And this is going to be sensitive because these captains are now all family.
I don't know if I have a rank, but I've got my favourites and I've got the ones I can do without.
The watching we've been doing, we should note this at this early point, in addition to saying, right, we're going to be using these acronyms, TNG, DS9 and so on. As kids, I was exposed to the Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, Voyager cluster. Those, as far as I was concerned, even though I had seen one or two of the original series from the 60s, I'd seen them on telly, they were rerun all the time. Even though I'd seen some of the films that came out in the 80s that used those characters, even though I was aware that there was original series Star Trek, it was the Next Generation that was the original series for me as a kid. And Deep Space Nine and Voyager all happening within the same story space at roughly the same time, I thought, that stuff was all home. And I, as far as I was aware, the original series was slightly macabre from what I could remember as a kid, as a very young kid, and also really slow. And I think it was because I'd seen The Cage, the originally unaired pilot, broadcast on TV in the 80s, and it's really sedate. And as a kid, you just kind of, you want things to rattle along and you want stuff to happen. As my own daughter has pointed out recently, when we accidentally sat down with her and watched a really quite courtroom drama episode of Discovery, there wasn't enough fighting and space puke. That is a thing in Star Trek. There will be some cerebral episodes that really gradually get you to think about the concepts. So, you know, as a very young child, found that a bit alienating. Next Generation, it had pace, even though it's full of tributes to the original series, it's a different sort of beast. And this is something that has become really apparent in watching the original series. It's got a lot more license than the original series had. The direct comparison that you can do between the episode in the original series where everyone gets infected with a virus that makes them drunk, and the episode very early in season one of The Next Generation where everyone gets infected with the same virus that makes everyone drunk, is the difference between people going a bit nuts in the first one and doing things that are a bit out of character in the original series, and in TNG, everyone getting very sexy.
And Wesley wrecking the ship and her Wesley Crusher.
We should also note that amongst these family members we have acquired during these past 2 years, and you know, with me it's reacquiring, but there's so much I hadn't seen as a child. Data is somebody with whom I feel I can identify quite extensively. Yeah. And you have said the same about T'Pol.
I have. Haven't you? Yeah. I think initially B'Elanna in Voyager was the one I went, I understand some of her anger, but her anger's coming from a place I don't necessarily understand, but I think to an extent that duality of identity is there with her because she's half Klingon, half human, and has had a very difficult upbringing because of that. So, and I think she's very interesting in terms of the mixed race experience, and I think she presents a really interesting exploration of anger as an emotion. But then it was when we watched Enterprise, T'Pol, I just felt seen. People say that, you know, I finally felt seen. I'm somebody, I've been described by people from the outside who maybe don't know me that well as quite aloof. They think I'm, you know, oh, this is a bit beneath me, whereas I'm usually cowering in a corner because I've got an anxiety disorder and nobody's interested in talking to me, you know. Mm. Or some people have had the impression that I'm a bit too cool for school, but that's not my internal experience. I'm externally have this coolness or something, or detachment. But inside, there's just a tumultuous amount going on to manage. And when they really explore what it is to be Vulcan properly with her for the first time, because there's not really a lot of Vulcan, there's no Vulcan main characters until Tuvok, you know, in Voyager. And Tuvok's quite old. He's over 100. He's also a man. You know, it's very different. But when you explore a female Vulcan properly for the first time, and she's a bit younger, she's in her 60s, which is about the equivalent of being around my age, sort of your 30s or something, maybe late 20s even younger. That's quite young for a Vulcan adult. She's a Vulcan who is actually finding it very challenging to manage her emotions, and then stuff happens to her because she's really interested in humans and human way of life. And she experiments a bit, and then she meets these quite radical Vulcans, and she experiments a bit more, and things go a bit wrong, and things happen without her consent. And so she has these experiences with her health and the decline of that. How they deal with her, I thought, was some just really excellent television, you know. And in the 2000s, you're starting to get a far better understanding of more neurological conditions like autism and ADHD, and especially because these are conditions that are very difficult to diagnose in women. So women with neurodiversity are socially conditioned in certain ways, and I think being able to explore maybe something along those lines with a Vulcan character, you know, an alien character, it just gives you that safe space to really play around with those ideas and then think about them in terms of allegory for humans.
And notably, that's something we have recognised happening across the next... actually, we've noticed elements of it in the original series, but it certainly happens across the Next Generation and Deep Space Nine and Voyager, such that the story of one of these many arcs that spans the many series is the story of just recognising that some people are gay.
Yeah.
You can't do that in the original series, but you can make some vague, implicit, metaphorical allusions to it. Mm-hmm. You can't do it in The Next Generation, but you can make some slightly less vague, slightly less buried allusions to it. And that continues up until the point when, I think it's in 2016, in Star Trek Beyond, that we finally have an openly gay character and it's not a big deal. Mm-hmm. And then in Star Trek Discovery, from the beginning, we've got a gay couple. Something that Gene Roddenberry said that he definitely wanted to feature in Next Generation, but he had so much pushback. His career was just people pushing back and going, no, audiences won't be okay with that. And so we had slightly less coded every single time references to it. Even having the first, no, it's almost like not the first on-screen girl-girl kiss in Deep Space Nine, but it was an early girl-girl kiss in Deep Space Nine. And it's supposed to be between a woman who has been a man before kissing the woman to whom she was married when she was a man. So it's not technically a girl-girl kiss psychologically, even though it is physically. So, you know, there's one of the ways they bury this. We'll get on to the implicit commentaries on sex, sexuality,
and gender and everything,
That are involved in being a Trill later. Okay, I'm done. I finished that review. So what did you want to talk about?
You're fully functional, aren't you, Shiel?
I am programmed in multiple techniques.
We've also tried to do a lot of working out of what nationality might these aliens be.
We'll do a whole hour of this episode just on that. And it changes over time as well.
It does change, yeah, because I think, you know, at times the Klingons are quite Russian, but at times they're maybe more Japanese, at times they're maybe more Celtic. I actually think they're really Celtic, but I don't know if that's deliberate or not. There are some parts of the language that sound actually like different versions of the Gaelic language.
All right, so there's several generations of it.
Mm.
In the original series, the Klingons appear to be Chinese, both in appearance and in their depiction as being a rising enemy that is associated with...
I don't know, because China would have been communist at the time, wouldn't it?
Oh, that's it, yeah. They're kind of... I'm constantly reminded of the Manchurian candidate. And okay. Manchuria is a territory which part of it is in Russia and part of it is in... China. Okay. The Manchurian candidate is entirely about Russian and Chinese communist governments, or at least the agents for Russian and Chinese communist governments, teaming up to create these sleeper agents in the US. And I think that what we get in the original series Klingons is this implicit sense of, you know, obviously the Russians are our, wiggling fingers in the air in an audio medium, our enemy, but obviously, the Chinese are as well, because they also have a communist government. I think that's what's going on in the original series, at least, with these Klingons that only appear alien by dint of the fact that they're generally shot with wide-angle lenses.
Mm.
They just have exactly the same sort of look about Klingons, maybe with slightly longer moustaches and slightly darker skin, as is given to, say, Romulans. But they'll shoot them with wide-angle lenses to make their noses look quite bulbous compared to humans.
But it's just the idea of the Klingon Empire and that there's an emperor. I think it's quite imperialistic. And that's what was... And the type of moustache, because they have that sort of thinnish moustache that goes down and it looks... It's quite Japanese to me. So I was wondering if it was maybe more Japanese intentionally.
I think that moustache, it partly alludes to the Fu Manchu figure, which who is in the history of fiction is one of these, again, wiggling fingers in the air in an audio medium, yellow peril.
They're just
figures of the early 20th century, and that alludes to China. But
it could be just vaguely Oriental.
That's the thing, that vague Oriental thing, in the Vulcans and the Romulans and the Klingons, in the original series, they all overlap and there's a kind of soup there.
Yeah.
Particularly with the episode we just watched, the first one of season two of the original series, where they go and discover Vulcan. This planet, which is just... It oozes logic. Mm-hmm. It totally doesn't when they go and discover it. It's full of ritual and superstition and people fighting to the death. It's just, it's completely incompatible with the logic principle. Right, so Klingons, by the time we get to the next generation, are now Russians.
Yeah.
In fact, our man Worf, when he's brought up on Earth, is brought up by Russians in what seemed to be a completely appropriate adoption scenario where no humans could take this Klingon child other than some double-R'd Russians. By that point, what we have with the Vulcans and the Romulans is this, it's been explained as being this kind of cousins situation, such that it's quite clear that the Vulcans are Japanese. Mm. They are these possible competitors, possible allies on the world stage as real champions of science and of capitalism. So Vulcans, Japanese, and their cousins are the much less logical, much less into cooperating with everyone Romulans, and they correspond to Chinese people. Okay, that's become pretty clear by that point, is that we now have Vulcans, Japanese, Romulans, Chinese, Klingons, Russians. And we also have the introduction of the Ferengi in the next generation, who are, I know, we're going to do this a lot over the next, because, it's kind of woke in some places, and we love that, and vegetarianism and everything, but the Ferengi are almost certainly Jewish, aren't they?
They're very coded as stereotypical Jews, I think.
Yeah, they're short, they're money-obsessed.
Their look is very Nosferatu, so it was that phrase, fear of the Eastern Jews kind of thing in Germany.
And it's in Deep Space Nine that we get introduced to two more species who seem very, very familiar to you. The Bajorans and the Cardassians.
Yeah, I'm not sure how much intentionality there is, but certainly at that time, and certainly looking at it as a post-conflict drama, which is a massive interest of mine, you know, the Bajorans feel like the Irish and the Cardassians feel like the British. I think a lot of the story arcs that come out between them in DS9 really explore that in a big way. And I don't know how intentional that was, but it maps on quite well. Because I think there are quite a few scenarios where that could be the case. A lot of DS9 is centered around, because the space station was Cardassian and it was orbiting the planet of Bajor. And then the Cardassians withdraw after a 50-year occupation. And the Federation, in a UN-type role, takes over the station in collaboration with the Bajorans, because they would really like Bajor to get back on its feet and become a member of the Federation. And then there's a lot of tension because Bajor doesn't really want anything. They want to be independent. They don't really want to be part of this other thing. But it's a bit like Ireland being part of the European Union. So it's its own free state, but it becomes part of the European Union. So it becomes part of something bigger than itself.
And the dates still will match up because Deep Space Nine runs from 1993 to 1999.
Yeah.
That is peace process.
That is the peace process period. Time for sure. So I really got a lot out of that allegory, if you can call it that. I thought it was a really interesting way of exploring that, and it maps on really well.
I'm sure we've noticed and forgotten. This is the thing, we've done so much forgetting and not writing stuff down over the past 2 years. I'm sure we've noticed and forgotten many more correspondences between species in Star Trek and real world.
I don't know who the Andorians are, but I like that they're blue and I love their antennae. It's their antennae in Enterprise because they're animatronic and they wiggle. And I'm wiggling my fingers in the way that their antennae wiggle and they're so cute.
That one episode when Jeffrey Combs...
Oh, I know what you're going to say. Yeah.
And that Jeffrey Combs, the Andorian that he plays, was Shran. Yeah, and Jeffrey Combs, he plays character after character after character in Deep Space Nine that keeps getting killed off.
Yes.
Or keeps getting humiliated in some way. And then finally, he gets a character in Deep Space Nine who's a long-running character and who is, although initially an antagonist, he becomes quite an important ally to... Starfleet.
To Archer
in Starfleet, yeah. Right, so, and yeah, there is one moment when he's in Archer's low-ceilinged ready room on the Enterprise, and he walks, and there's this kind of running gag about people banging their head on the low ceilings.
Yeah, because Scott Bakula, who plays Captain Archer, he's very tall, and he has this quite cramped little office off the bridge, and there's a long-running thing of him always having to duck underneath this beam that goes across.
And there's one moment when Shran's in there too, and they're having a very heated discussion, and Shran walks under that same beam and his two antennae, they bend backwards to
so
duck.
Cute.
So somebody somewhere had the job of, probably by remote control, deflating something within those antennae so that they would move out the way.
I bet remote controllers, because Jeffrey Combs, he's just the right height to not have to flinch or bend or anything when he walks under that beam. But it's just the way his body doesn't flinch at all, and the little antenna just bend backwards. We had to watch that about 3 or 4 times before we could move on to the rest of the episode.
It was sublime.
It's just so clever, because there's no reaction, it's just the little antenna that's the sort of thing. Those are the little gems that Enterprise is really great for, and I think it was just poorly served by the network at the time.
And its theme tune.
You have a real second point about that. Are you okay there?
That's fine. It's just my shoulders. Too much time sitting at a keyboard, you know.
Oh, I could teach you Vulcan neuropressure. You can even stimulate your own neural nodes. It will help you sleep. Or there's Andorian ale. It's blue.
See, Andorians, Tellarites, humans and Vulcans, Enterprise implies that these four species, they're the founding species of the Federation. And so we're inclined to think about, well, it's an allusion to something that happened in a post-conflict time. Maybe it's about the Second World War, about the formation of the United Nations already existed at that point, didn't it? Maybe it's about NATO. So if it's NATO, maybe the Andorians are supposed to be... who else were signatories of NATO? Maybe they're Canadians.
They're quite icy. They are from an icy moon.
Mm.
Because that's the thing about what seems to become clear in Enterprise, which wasn't clear when Andorians were in the original series, as I understand it, is Andor is a gas planet and Andoria is the moon of that planet. And it's actually the moon that they come from, and it's really icy. So the Andorians are blue with white hair, and then there's a What are the other race called? Because they explore there's another race and they're white.
Yeah, colored. So a kind of cousin, not a cousin species, because they can reproduce. So we're talking a cousin group within the same species.
They're
and I've forgotten, yeah. They're just basically Andorians with whiter skin.
Yeah.
And different, slightly differently coloured eyes.
Yeah. But they've been living underground as well, which is why they're so very pale. Because when I say they're white, I mean they're pure white. Yeah. Whereas the Andorians are quite bright blue. Well, at least they're very bright blue in Discovery.
Even bluer.
Even bluer in Discovery than they are previously.
And they're the same colour as their ale.
I suppose these are things that go back to the original series, because it was just what colour body paint can we put on these people today? Because we've got the Orions who are green. Yeah. And, you know, I don't know who the Orions are supposed to be, but they do really cool stuff with them in Enterprise.
Yeah, I think, okay, Orions. Probably a vague Middle Eastern
thing. Indian or just South Asian or something like that. Because, they do have quite, because it's quite a dark green and they have black hair.
Oh, and
they're very exotic and there's dancing and the women are very alluring and that sort of stuff.
And while we're on, well, we're not anymore, but while we have mentioned Bajorans and Cardassians, the Marquis
are
an important category, because the Marquis are all either Federation citizens or actually Starfleet people who have officially people who've left Starfleet, say, and they've formed this terrorist organization that is opposed to the deal.
Well, they're freedom fighters. It's that sort of thing. Is one person sees them as terrorists, another will see them as freedom fighters, and there's an ongoing argument about that language.
So I think that specifically, in the context of the Bajorans being Irish and the Cardassians being British, I think that specifically alludes to ongoing conflict in Northern Ireland, doesn't it? The Marquis are almost certainly Northern Irish Republicans.
Yeah, they're probably a faction of the IRA or, you know, INLA, something like that. They're a paramilitary organisation.
And of course, the big narrative of Voyager is Marquis being reabsorbed back into the fold, not being cut off as the enemy, but being identified with, common ground with them being shared, and just some smoothing over of differences. And yes, this is all very, very American. Right. Tellarites kind of look like pigs.
There's not much characterization of them, I don't think.
No, presumably we are. I know for sure we are going to meet them in the original series. We just haven't done so yet.
Yeah.
I think that's it for our main species.
Main ones, yeah.
I hesitate to call them races because
we haven't really done the Trill, but they're more. So the Trill, it's more with gender. The Trill are a species that can combine and host a symbiont, so this big worm slug-like creature that can be inserted into them surgically and becomes part of them. And the symbiont can hold the memories of that person. They join together, so they become one person. The biological sex of the host doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It's just whether they can join or not. And so the Trill go through a training process of many years. Not every Trill is suitable to become a host, and only certain people will be. And they usually choose the elite. So that's where we get Dax, who is in DS9. And then there's a whole big backstory with Benjamin Sisko, who is the commander, then captain, who takes over for the Federation. Deep Space Nine, so there's all of that. But yeah, so the symbiont then is its own identity, but it lives through the host, and the host will change. So they live out long lives. So Curzon Dax dies before DS9 begins, but he's over 100 years old. And then the Dax symbiont is given to Jadzia, who becomes Jadzia Dax, and you take on the name of your symbiont. And there's a Trill in TNG as well. They explore that with Beverly Crusher, falls in love with a Trill man.
Yeah.
And then he is fatally wounded, but the symbiont could survive if they have another host, and is temporarily hosted by the Frakes. That's Shagger Riker, Jonathan Frakes. And it's only temporary because he's human, so they can't really do that long term. And then, of course, in Discovery, they explore long-term hosting from a human. But this is very temporary because it's not going to hold, but it'll just keep the symbiont alive until a new Trill host can come. And then the new Trill host is a woman. And so that's really the first time where they directly deal with it, potentially same-sex relationship. And how they handle it is Beverly going, I don't think I can do this yet, because I think they hadn't really worked out the trill very well, you know, very much at that point, because it's basically like I'm exactly the same person. I was basically a blank sheet when I was that other person, but the symbiont has taken over. Whereas in DS9, they flesh it out a bit more and it's more like they combine with each other. So the Dax symbiont carries the memories of Curzon and all the previous hosts, and they explore the previous hosts throughout the series. And then there's another host, because Jadzia later on dies, and Ezri is a trill who is untrained but happens to be on a ship that's transporting the symbiont. There's so much of this stuff. How do I know all this? This is desperate. This is so nerdy.
For sure, the trill allude to real world people who have a different relationship with their bodies from that which humans typically have. So my initial instinct was these allude to intersex people. Then, of course, at points, there's also indications that they allude to transgender people. These are categories that are not to be confused. Both of which categories mean that at times, trill can be used to create short-term same-sex love storylines.
Mm.
And it's very notable that in that Next Generation episode where we first meet the trill, that when Beverly realizes that the man she's fallen in love with, the kind of worm symbiont that was the man she'd fallen in love with, is now in a woman, she overtly says something like, "We're not ready yet for that sort of love." As if she's right just beneath the surface saying, our viewers of this right now in the US in about 1990 are not yet ready for this sort of love, but we're aware that it exists and that it counts. So it's a bit out of line with all these other things where we go, oh yeah, this particular species from this planet that corresponds to this nation on Earth or this political group. But what we could also do with the trill is take the fact that for them, the symbionts at least are effectively immortal. We could identify them with a religious belief system on Earth which believes in reincarnation, because that's a kind of real world version of reincarnation being a thing. So perhaps the trill are supposed to be South Asian or maybe a bit Buddhist. But they are, you know, nonetheless, they're used to say a lot of things about real world people.
In the middle of that tangent, I was trying to say that in the 90s, we didn't have that language that we have now around transgenderism or intersex people. It was you're a transvestite or a transsexual who's had a surgical sex change, you know, for example, whereas we have much more nuanced language around those things now. And so I think it was a really interesting way of being able to explore your gender identity and that it can change or that it can just be fluid. You know, it's interesting how there are times when Jadzia or Adira in Discovery, who is the human character who has taken on a symbiont so that the symbiont wouldn't die, and they've joined successfully. Ewan and Adira is a non-binary actor playing a non-binary character as well, which is really interesting. They're really exploring that with them, where there are days where they feel they're challenging one of their very clearly masculine hosts, prior hosts, and they feel very masculine. You know, Jadzia is super into the Klingons. She's really into fighting.
And all of the face biting.
And all of it, all of the quite violent sexual rituals that come with being Klingon as well. She's super into all of that. But then there are times when she's very gentle and more, air quotes, feminine. She's very dance-like because one of her prior hosts was a dancer. There are things physically she couldn't do when she was Jadzia, but now that she's Jadzia Dax, she's got more dexterity because of the dancing, because of the fighting abilities. She's got language abilities she never had before. They become more than themselves.
Yeah, there's even a series in an episode in Deep Space Nine where Jadzia Dax is arrested for a crime, but it's a crime that Curzon Dax carried out. And they have to get into this issue of, if you're the same person as the previous Dax because of the Dax, and that previous Dax was not two separate consciousnesses living in the same body, then doesn't that mean that that person's acts and any responsibility for any crime they might have committed, those are also yours as well, because you've still got that person's consciousness within you? They solve that by having a speech from Sisko in which he basically goes, no, when the previous host dies, their consciousness is removed from the symbiont a little bit. The metaphor he uses is, it's a bit like dissolving salt in water, and then you boil away the water and that just leaves the salt, and then the new host is a load more water that then has that salt dissolved into it. So that's a perfect little metaphor for going, actually, no, they're not the same person as the previous person. They just carry the memories of that previous person with them, exactly, so that they can occasionally have have a chat with them.
Yeah, or suddenly they can fix a piece of equipment because a power host was an engineer and they've got the residual memories of what they could do, you know, that sort of thing. Yeah, exactly.
Hey, Blair, do you fancy learning a bit of repointing? I've been mastering it recently and it's actually really easy and it's quite relaxing when you get the hang of it.
Damn it, Sheil, I'm a podcaster, not a bricklayer. I think this episode is sponsored by socks knitted by Auntie Chris.
Auntie Christine.
Auntie Christine. So a big hello to Andrew's Aunt Chris and Uncle Tim, if you're listening, because they tend to listen to the ones that you're in.
Oh, so they do. Yeah.
Yeah.
The beasts.
We're both wearing our very special socks.
Yes, thank you, Auntie Christine.
From Auntie Christine. And I'd also like to say a big thank you to my mum and sister, because they mostly fund our Netflix habits.
To the founders of the feast.
Yes, certainly my mum this year she got me Netflix vouchers for my birthday and then for the winter solstice festivus winter break thing. So they're partly to blame for all of this nerdery, I have to say. It doesn't just lie with us. We were enabled.
The enablers are always somewhere behind the scenes. All right. I suppose the first thing to do is to establish that what we have been watching has had definite generations. And not just that the next generation is the second generation of show. No, there is a definite generation, which is TNG, Deep Space Nine, and Voyager. That's a single generation. Mm-hmm. It happens at roughly the same time. And they don't just constitute a generation because they take place at the same time. They constitute a generation because they have roughly identical story principles, which is that while you sometimes have two-parters, where part one ends with a cliffhanger, the norm is that each episode is a self-contained story. Each series may have a shallow arc of steadily finding out a few more things about a mystery, steadily encountering more and more of the Borg, say, for example. That's one quite big arc that happens. While those may happen, every episode is self-contained. Then, Enterprise.
Yeah, I don't know, though. I think in DS9, though, I think the Dominion War is quite a big story arc that happens in there. The first series that does three-part arcs as well.
Yes, right, Kay, I stand corrected about that. There's arc stuff in Deep Space Nine. When I ran through all those dates earlier on, Enterprise started about 5 months after Voyager wrapped up. Now, that was new, because Voyager started while Deep Space Nine was happening, and Deep Space Nine started while TNG was happening.
They very clearly overlapped with each other. They had characters from another series pass on the baton, as it were, in their pilot episodes.
Yes. There was definitely forking of storylines happening there. Yeah. With Enterprise, it starts after Voyager wraps up. It initially starts off with that same story principle, but then you can see a gradual resetting of the way the Enterprise is told, because clearly its ratings aren't good. Someone's trying to improve its ratings by changing the format. Yeah. And one of the ways that they try to do that is that across the whole of Series 3, there's one single arc. Mm. While there are some relatively self-contained episodes, it's always, oh, we found a bit more information that's going to help us solve this problem with the Zindi. And that we hadn't seen across a whole season before. Mm-hmm. So the point is, I suppose, to point out that we're going to be calling TNG a series, DS9 a series, Voyager a series, Enterprise a series, Discovery a series. We're going to be calling these things series, even though at some points they wobble over to that point where they're serials rather than series. They are mostly series. Discovery gets proper serial, particularly in seasons 2 and 3. We're going to be calling them series nonetheless, so that we have them distinct, because this word series has a separate use in which it's as distinct from season. In the UK, we use series to mean season. We'll talk about how great series 3 of The Wire was, for example. And it wasn't. Series 2 of The Wire. But of course, in the US, they'll refer to season 2 of The Wire.
Which is interesting, because a season is most of the year in US TV series.
Whereas here...
it is actually one season because it's usually 6 episodes or 8 episodes or something.
Yeah, as distinct from 26. Yeah, so series as distinct from season rather than series insisting that every single episode is self-contained, even though for most of TNG, most of DS9, most of Voyager, even most of Enterprise, they are self-contained. Mm. So, vocabulary done.
I think it's quite important to acknowledge. I mean, we said it before, but I think it's worth going into in a bit of detail. I do really feel for Enterprise, I think it was poorly timed and poorly served, and that was no one's fault. It was just world events happened. But the popularity of the TNG generation, they didn't really want to let up on that, but those stories needed to just stop and pause and take a breather. Paramount was in charge at the time, wasn't it, still?
Yep.
So in 2000, Voyager's wrapping up because they have this thing where, as we've established, they go for 7 seasons and they stop. So they end at 7.
You can hear them going, our work here is done.
Yeah, it's a long time, you know, and it's a very, you know, because it is the bulk of a year. It's usually 9 or 10 months that the cast and crew are working on this one show, and they're doing 18-hour days sometimes, 6 to 7 days in a row, maybe 1 or 2 days off, and then they're back again for another, you know, solid week. You know, they're not getting weekends. They're not really getting time with their families. It's a really, really tough environment. It's physically exhausting, and the actors, well, it's brilliant to have steady work, and a lot of them will jump on it because it's steady work in a very intense environment, very competitive environment. It's a lot of your life to give up. So 7 years is a good number where you can stop and go off and do something else and do other projects. And still, if you've been wise, you can live off the fruits of that. And then, of course, by that time, you know, by the end of Voyager, certainly the conventions are happening. And a lot of these people, they can live off those for the rest of their lives, pretty much just doing the conventions, the cruises, all that sort of thing. But Enterprise, I think, was probably quite rushed in the production. There was this idea to go right back to the very start because there's a bit of lore about the very first captain, you know, the very first, not Federation, it's the organization that would become Starfleet, you know, their very first captain on the ship called the Enterprise being called Archer. So I think they go back and they want to develop on that and make adventures about that. And it's really back to basics because you're having to go, right, this needs to be 100 years before the Enterprise we're familiar with from the original series.
And I got very excited when we started watching Enterprise because essentially so gradually over TNG, DS9 and Voyager, technology had got to the point where it was essentially magic. It wasn't just, you know, that, what is it? It's Arthur C. Clarke's third law, which is that any sufficiently technologically advanced civilization is indistinguishable from magic. It wasn't just things that look like magic to the uninitiated. It was that it was essentially magic. You could just say, Tuvok, emit an inverse tachyon pulse, and then it would just fix everything. And so by the very last episode of Voyager, where they were basically trying to do the impossible and use the Borg's transwarp conduit network to get back to the Alpha Quadrant. They were up against the immovable object of Borg technology, but of course they were equipped with the unstoppable force of being able to do whatever they wanted with their great ship, which had just been tooled up by a help from future Janeway. And those two things, they could always just get better. So there was always this technology thing of, well, we're up against magic technology, we've got magic technology. Oh no, they've just made their technology more magic, so we'll just make our technology more magic. And that was a big result of going up against the Borg. So by the end of Voyager, the technology had just become something that meant that the laws of physics didn't apply to anyone ever. And within that environment, nothing's at stake. So when they went back to Enterprise, they went back to the 22nd century, I think, Enterprise.
So it begins 2151.
Yeah. They're going, right, we're going to a point when people are just starting to break the light barrier, when humans are just starting to break the light barrier. And they don't have shields. They don't have replicators. They've just been given transporter technology by the Vulcans and they're scared of it, which is fantastic.
I just keep wanting them to throw up all the time after it. You just want their stomach to be slightly misaligned or something. Some of their atoms to be just not in the right place.
So that introducing limitations, introducing actually being constrained by the laws of physics again, I was really excited about that.
Yeah.
So there was so much potential in Enterprise, squandered entirely by the theme tune.
Yeah, okay. I think we need to deal with this before we can. Because I'd like to get into the television context of the time of that history, you know, because 9/11 happens just as it's about to air and things just never really come right for it. And it's not the program's fault. Shows like 24, you know, counterterrorism becomes a big thing in TV.
Yeah.
And so then Enterprise goes down the counterterrorism route in season 3 because seasons 1 and 2 just haven't quite hit the mark. So, you know, they're desperate to try and improve the ratings. So they try and have a go at having a massive terrorism arc and they do something huge because it's spacey and it's huge. And so it's millions rather than thousands that are killed. And there's this massive revenge arc and counterterrorism arc.
And although they had flirted with post-traumatic stress in Picard, back in, it's called The Best of Both Worlds, there's that two-parter about where he becomes Borg and then gets freed. And then immediately after that, they have a Picard experiencing PTSD episode. Yeah. Although they had dealt with that before, in the form of Archer, they have this guy who, across the series, does thing after thing after thing, which is compromising his morality, such that by the end of the series, he's just this shell of a man who's constantly angry at everyone all the time. And so, true to form, they do devote the very next episode, beginning, I think it's the beginning of the fourth series, to a one where he has to go and face his demons.
Yeah.
He has to do what Picard did, face that PTSD, but it's much worse for him.
Yeah.
Even though, effectively, he's physically fine. He hasn't just had all these implants put into his body and had his consciousness changed. He's just done a bunch of morally compromised things.
Yeah.
Well, it goes ever so gently into that 24 territory of, well, we don't want to torture people, but we just have to now.
Anyway.
Yeah, and don't ask me why we have to.
Yeah. I mean, it goes into difficult areas and it felt quite cynical. And it's a shame because actually beyond that, I felt there were some really strong episodes of television, some really strong storylines and some really strong writing. You know, the characters are really coming to life. I just think there's some really excellent characters in that. And it was, again, just inching more and more into a greater diversity of types of character as well and backgrounds for those characters. I mean, Hoshi is foundational. I mean, all of the translation, universal translator technology that's taken so for granted in all the other series.
Yeah.
We see the origin of that in Hoshi Sato, who is this very young woman. She's 21 years old when Enterprise begins. So she's 25 when it ends. And she's a genius linguist who has this just capacity in her brain for language, but not just language. They show she can pinpoint accents and dialects to rural areas in North America. You know, she's incredible. And so her character gets fleshed out. She also, the very first ever trip to Risa, the pleasure planet, where everybody goes to get laid. It's actually through Riker that we really get introduced to that planet in TNG. He advises Picard to go there for a bit of R&R. And Riker likes to visit Risa. But actually, you know, in Enterprise, they establish they're the first humans to visit. It's the first Enterprise team. And Hoshi has a very nice time and she has sexual agency and nothing bad happens to her. And it's really fun, but bad things happen to all the blokes who go down. And it's, you know, in quite comic ways, you know, and it's a really fun episode, you know, and she just makes friends by picking up the language. She starts to speak Risa to people and they go, oh wow, you're speaking it and you've got the accent, that's really good.
And she also learns the language of someone else while she's there, isn't it? Of someone who isn't from Risa, who's got this extremely complex language, and he picks that up as well, and that's how they have this sexual relationship. And it just ends sweet. And she just leaves and that's it.
Weekend thing and it's really lovely and she goes back smiling and it's a really nice experience for her.
And no one's getting honey trapped.
No.
And no one's getting an alien parasite inserted into them.
Yeah, she has a nice time, whereas, isn't it, Trip and Reed, they get fleeced and end up in their underpants. And poor Travis, he breaks his leg or something, mountain climbing, something like that.
Yeah. And Archer is conned by an agent.
Can't remember. Yeah.
Oh, dear.
It's first season, so it feels like ages ago, but it's a really fun episode. You know, things like that where they just really establish character and they actually play with some sexual agency for the young woman and they don't shame her for, you know, what happens. She just has a lovely time and that's it. You know, so I really appreciated things like that they could do because finally they were in the 2000s and they were able to do that.
It's always step by tiny step.
Yeah.
But that step is way ahead. Of the steps that the average moral principle is willing to take. They're pushing. I was pushing as much as they can. And thanks to the Trek Culture channel, we're not the biggest Star Trek nerds by far. Thanks to the Trek Culture channel, I now know that they were doing something very similar with discourse about drugs during the 1980s. There's a conversation between Tashi Yar and little Wesley Crusher about drugs, which doesn't take the just say no line, which admits that people take drugs not because they're weak people, but because they're in horrible circumstances often. And that was really brave at the time. So there's lots of that. What are you tweeting about now? We have another segment to record.
Klingons do not procrastinate.
So we're going to talk about the theme tune.
Yeah, we'll probably need to build up to this. You know, the original series, I mean, that is... Even before I had a notion of ever watching any Star Trek, we all know that theme tune. It's just part of cultural currency, isn't it? It's just so embedded. We all know that distinctive theme tune. And now that we've got to season two and watching the original series, now we've got The Soprano in it, which really makes it.
New version, yeah. You know, we're learning about this all in the wrong order. Of course, what we were dipped in when we got to Enterprise, we had been dipped for 21 seasons in theme music that was descended from that original by way of Star Trek the Motion Picture.
Yeah.
Because the theme music for The Next Generation, it included the fanfare from the original series theme by Alexander Courage with Jerry Goldsmith's theme for Star Trek the Motion Picture. And then the theme music for Deep Space Nine is music that's very similar to the music for The Next Generation. Mm. And then the theme music for Voyager, which puts me on the verge of tears every time I hear it.
It's so beautiful.
Again, much the same thing. It was all just, but it was done with much longer sustained notes in order to get that sense of
longing feeling.
Yeah, that you got a long way to go before we're going to get home. Yeah. So that was all very similar. It was big, it was orchestral, and no one was singing. And then with Enterprise, what happened was an existing piece of music, which was called Faith of the Heart.
Rod Stewart, wasn't it?
Written by Diane Warren and performed by Rod Stewart. And it was performed for the soundtrack to the 1998 film Patch Adams.
Oh, yeah.
And then it was rewritten. Russell Watson reworked it as Where My Heart Will Take Me. As the theme music for Enterprise. Now, it was re-recorded, I think, for season 4. So there's a slightly different version, slightly more upbeat music to it.
For season 3, because you remember going, we can't watch the same tune anymore because this is so out of...
Yeah.
It's so incongruent to what we're seeing in every episode. Every episode was so traumatic and full of violence. And it's going, da, 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 da. You know, this music's so upbeat and hopeful.
And I just noticed, it was re-recorded for the 3rd and 4th seasons. It probably would have been appropriate for... Actually, with lyrics. I can't. Not with lyrics.
Well, it was a strange decision. And maybe that had something to do with... people not necessarily taking Enterprise that seriously, and then with it just being called Enterprise initially, people didn't associate it properly with Star Trek, so it didn't really take with the Trek audience that was already established.
Also, a song with the word faith in the title, given the attitude towards faith established by virtually all of the Star Trek so far, didn't fit at all with the tenor of the show.
Exactly. I think it was unfortunate. A lot about Enterprise is unfortunate. It didn't serve what it could have been and what parts of it were. I mean, the Denobulan Doctor, there's just so much that's great about Enterprise, and it was poorly served by some really crap decisions.
And let's look at what was great about Enterprise. Getting Scott Bakula to play the captain.
Yeah.
Wonderful. knowing what tends to happen to people when they play in science fiction, that was probably his way of going, right, I am going to get myself associated with a new character because Sam Beckett in Quantum Leap.
Yeah.
It took me a while when I first saw Enterprise at the time when it was broadcast to shed the, oh, that's Sam Beckett from Quantum Leap. Yeah, new person. And he changed, definitely changed. He was taking a lot of opportunities to get his top off. And to definitely do a thing that Sam Beckett had never done, which was really quite stridently issue orders to people to be a really quite authoritarian figure.
They did have that one where Dean Stockwell was in, which is lovely. We had really not long watched that. And then a couple of months later, Dean Stockwell passed away. But it was nice to have seen that, having them back together again, but being adversaries this time. But I think that was probably one of the things that misserved Enterprise, was that as great as Scott Bakula is and the character of Archer, there was too much emphasis on him. He had to be the hero every time. And I think that's something that I love Discovery, but there is too much of everything relies on Michael Burnham.
By the time we got to the last few series of Voyager, we'd established this vocabulary of, oh, this is
a Harrysode.
We'd established this vocabulary of, oh, this is a parasode.
Yeah.
Or this is a ninosode.
Balanosode.
You know, that's it. Yeah. Tuvokasodes. Every now and then you get a Tuvokasode.
It's a doctor-sode, whatever.
EMH-sode,
EMH-sode, something like that. Because it's like, okay, right, we're with this character as the main person. So good. Great.
And that had happened throughout Next Generation. Often it was a Picardisode because it was an episode about what the crew, as headed by him, had to do in coming up against a particular adversary or problem. And he would be the main one to solve it. But very soon you'd start to get Geordisodes, where it would follow Geordi across a day and he'd be the one who'd have to solve the problem.
Some of the really great ones are about Data. Very often you're directed by one of them, by Jonathan Frakes or LeVar Burton or Patrick Stewart.
And let's nail this banner up right now. As an opportunity for actors to get into directing, Star Trek has been great.
Yeah.
Noticing how much of season 3 of Star Trek Discovery Jonathan Frakes directed.
He's still going.
Because
LeVar Burton did loads of all the others as well.
We see his name a lot in Voyager and Enterprise as director.
Yes, and Enterprise, a lot of Enterprise was directed by Robbie McNeil, who was Tom Paris in Voyager, and he went through the Academy, the Directing Academy, and I love the Delta Flyers. It's a fantastic podcast. It's a rewatch that Robert Duncan McNeil and Garrett Wong, who played Tom Paris and Harry Kim in Voyager, they make this together. It's a rewatch series, so they talk about each and individual episode every time. And Robbie McNeil, because he's since become a director rather than an actor, it's really interesting for him because he watches the episodes more as a director. He can barely remember the acting side of it for himself because he spent so much of the time observing the directors and learning about the production. He spent more energy on that than really, but you know, he still turns up and he does his acting really well. But yeah, so that's been a really interesting thing. And the same thing happened with Roxanne Dawson, who was B'Elanna Torres in that show. She is now more well known as a director, and she's been a director and a producer and executive producer on loads of other shows now since then, and films as well.
That principle of a character gets an episode, and it might be even a relatively minor character. I mean, think of the Barclay episode in TNG.
I love Barclay so much.
So sweet. I'm missing that now that we've got onto Discovery because they're almost all about Michael Burnham.
And that is the thing as well. Actually, you do have those recurring characters. So the likes of Lieutenant Barclay, played by Dwight Schultz, who's very well known as Howling Mad Murdoch in A-Team, you know, or like so we mentioned already, Jeffrey Combs playing lots of different characters. Vaughn Armstrong plays lots of different characters across those of the series. Garrick, Andrew Robinson in Deep Space Nine, you've got these really important recurring characters who are not main cast.
J.G. Hertzler.
Oh,
I love Martok. His voice.
So good.
When you hear that voice come out of somebody else's mouth, you know, as in out of the mouth of a character who isn't Martok. There's such a thing as a tasty voice.
Oh, who is it who plays Gowron? He's brilliant as a CIs with him.
Honor on you. and your house.
He's yeah. so great.
Eyes double in size when he says it, yeah.
Yeah.
A tendency to concentrate on minor characters mm-hmm. is a thing. And that, I suppose, has held over onto Discovery as well. We get lots of, you know, this particular minor character gets a scene at this point. But there's no such thing in Discovery as an equivalent of a Geordisode or a Datasode.
Probably because it is more serialized rather yeah. than episodic. So the ideas in the earlier ones is that you're going along nicely. They're on their missions, blah blah blah. Oh, a thing happens and it centers on this one character. So you're driving into their character a bit more. But I suspect that came about because of what happened with Denise Crosby, because she left before the end of season one of TNG because yes. she just wasn't getting anything to do. So she's playing Tasha Yar, who was the chief security officer on the Enterprise. And, you know, the actress was really frustrated at just having these perfunctory lines. And something very similar had happened with Nichelle Nichols in the original series, but she claims in her autobiography that Martin Luther King convinced her to stay because yeah. just her being on TV in every episode at some point, even if all she said was "hailing frequencies open," which she got really fed up with, as you would. And she's a brilliant actress and she's got such presence, but she was getting so little to do. So, you know, for the whole of the first season, that's basically all she says is "healing frequencies open, sir."
Message coming in from Starfleet Command, sir.
Yeah, that's yeah. it. And it's really boring for her. And she's just a set of legs, you know, but because she's a set of brown legs, that's really important because representation really does matter. We were talking the other day about Mae Jemison, is it? Who is the astronaut who was inspired to become an astronaut and join NASA because of Nichelle Nichols. And, you know, so it is groundbreaking in that sense.
And who also got a cameo as a transport officer, yeah, I think.
Yeah, she was in an episode of TNG and yeah. they met on the set and everything, and it was really special. But, you know, with Denise Crosby as Tasha Yar, she's got so much to give and she got really fed up. And you think by the late 80s, even a white woman would have something more to do. But no, I mean, and it was annoying because it was great that they had a woman, a really kick-ass woman, being the security officer.
And she got to do that fight in about the third episode.
Yeah.
In the rather racially problematic
Very
episode.
Very problematic yeah. episode, which, but... Yeah,
that fight with that princess in which someone had to die, uh-huh. but then they would very quickly beam that person up to Enterprise and make them not be dead.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, most of that fight was done by stunt performers, so Denise Crosby wouldn't have had much involvement in it. But yeah. she did get to do that scene with Data. She did get to say to him, "You are fully functional, aren't you?"
I know, but they made her so early. They really sexualized her. And it was because of the thing, you know, this virus that made them all a bit drunk.
Not so drunk that she didn't have the composure to perfectly do her hair with a little kiss curl.
Well, maybe there's a future technology that just does it for you. I don't know. But so her frustration meant that she wanted out of her contract. So they killed her off. They were quite merciless about that. So rather than just let her transfer and give her the option of coming back, they killed her.
And Beverly Crusher, Gates McFadden, who actually also works under another name, doesn't she? When she's
yeah,
not
she
acting.
Used, when she's being a choreographer, she uses one of her other names. I can't remember
This is shameful. She did just transfer off the Enterprise.
Well,
Beverly Crusher, at
that
the end
was different because I think the showrunners or the writers or something just wanted to do something different.
So it wasn't her choice.
I don't think. And then they brought in another doctor, Pulaski, is it? And she's brilliant. But then I think because fans petitioned to get Beverly Crusher back, because there is a bit of a thing between her and Picard. So I think the fans really wanted that back. So Pulaski just isn't there for the third season, and Beverly Crusher comes back, and that's it.
Just by Pulaski. It's Cheryl Gates McFadden, okay? Uh-huh. Sorry, Gates McFadden there. I suppose now we're here, we ought to talk about season two of The Next Generation.
Do we have to?
Well, let's at least just mention it. Right.
Okay.
Because in The Next Generation, as we have both learned from reading interviews with Patrick Stewart and so on. It was not at all clear during those first two series that this thing would run for seven... I'm saying series as well, aren't I? For seven seasons. And there's even a bit I'd noticed what looked like an outtake that hadn't been caught in one of the episodes in the, early in the first season of TNG, when Picard is walking into a turbo lift and it's a shot of him from the side. And when the turbo lift doors open, he opens his mouth as if he's going, "Oh," and I don't think he is doing that. It could be because they always cut the sound out when they put the sound of the turbo lift doors on. He's doing a big open mouthed face as if he's doing a kind of joke face to the person who's on the other side of the turbo lift doors that we can't see. And you'd think, oh, that's just them horsing around on set. That's got to be an outtake. But no, that made it into the finished episode. There was a kind of informality about their work during the first couple of seasons. And it was because they were expecting to hear any moment that that's it. It's all over. This farce of trying to resurrect Star Trek in TV form is over. And it very nearly was because of how season two ended, because season two ended with them running out of money and having to do what was in effect a clip show for the last episode of season two.
It's pretty horrendous.
Yeah, season two, it was the one episode out of TNG that... It was the one season, sorry, of all of TNG that had just 22 episodes. Mm. So it was four episodes short. They just ran out of money. And for the very last episode, all they could afford was Dr. Pulaski, a couple of other characters, I think including Troy, Marina Sirtis, a bit of dialogue with them, with Riker lying on a table, an original scene in which Riker gets infected with something, and that's it. The rest was clips cut in from previous episodes, which are supposed to be him remembering things, having this internal battle. It was awful. It is the worst episode of Star Trek ever.
I think even Frakes called it a piece of shit. Yes. I'm quoting him.
That's a low point. Who knows whether they knew at that point whether they had been renewed for a third season? But that's the operation of people who don't care whether they've been renewed yet. And of course, it's not the actors, it's the showrunners who are making those decisions.
Mm.
But gets renewed for a third season. And from that point onwards, just goes from strength to strength and becomes...
Yeah, amazing. I mean, by the end of season three, and then that's the introduction of the Borg.
Yes.
It's gripping. You know, I think by that was probably the stage where I was invested.
Okay, Borg. Earlier on, we were talking about what certain things in Star Trek correspond to in the real world. Now, of course, we didn't mention the Borg. We were kind of going, what other species are there? Well, there's the Borg, who aren't a species. Now, it's pretty damn close to the surface that the Borg are communists, because they have a collective consciousness. Mm-hmm. They are collectivists. That's hardly insightful for us to point that out. But it's important to note whether they're just a new version of Russians, because they're invented towards the end of the 1980s. So 87, 88, 88, 89, 89, it's kind of 89, 90 point. We're talking thawing of the Cold War. We're talking that point where there's a classic line in Terminator 2 where young John Connor goes, "Why attack Russia? Aren't they our friends now?" That whole "they're our friends now" thing. But I don't think the Borg are supposed to be Russians. I think they're supposed to be homegrown communists. They're supposed to be socialists amongst the American population. And that's why they're so dangerous, because they are on their way to Earth. They're not stopping at conventional boundaries. They're not recognizing the boundaries of the Federation. But of course, much more interestingly, the Dominion.
Mm.
Okay, we didn't mention the Dominion. The Dominion have a three-tier hierarchy with the founders, or changelings, at the top, who are regarded as gods by the bottom stratum. The middle stratum, which is the Vorta, who are clones, genetically engineered by the founders in order to act as this middle stratum of the hierarchy. And then the soldiers are the Jem'Hadar, and they're again genetically designed from scratch and designed in order to be biologically dependent on this substance called white, which means that if they somehow get free of the Vorta and the changelings, they'll just go mad and die within a couple of weeks when they run out of white.
And they seem to be coded as African slaves, I think.
Well, yes. That particular hierarchy of rulers, an intermediate class that they use so they never have to have anything to do with the people who they rule, and then the people who they rule, that was the principle of the British Empire.
Mm-hmm.
It was using Indians, that is, people from South Asia, as an administrative class in African colonies during the 19th and early 20th centuries. We've already mentioned before that the Cardassians are supposed to correspond respond to the English or to British imperialists, but the Dominion, they do almost exactly the same thing.
Yeah,
they
but there's different flavours of British imperialism because yeah. there are the ones who went west and they're the ones who went east. And I think yeah. the ones who went west immediately to Ireland are what we're thinking about with Cardassia and Bajor, but also then further afield to the Americas. And then yeah. I suppose there's just general European colonisation of the Americas is stuff that's happening there too. There's a lot more Native American type stuff happening, mostly in Voyager, yes. with Chakotay. Definitely with the Dominion, there's a very big allegory of those things.
It's symptomatised in just how easily the Cardassians team up with the Dominion
yeah.
after the Dominion start invading the Alpha Quadrant.
Yeah, because they're flavours of the same thing.
Yeah.
But even the Cardassians come a cropper because of that. The Dominion is just so callous and cruel.
So the Cardassians, they become subjects of the Dominion and they have mm-hmm. to have their own revolution
mm-hmm.
to free Cardassia from
and
the Dominion.
And they get yeah. Bajor to help, that yeah. Bajor helps them.
So it's a little bit like mm-hmm. the English deciding that even they don't want to be part of the Empire anymore. It's basically going, everyone needs to found their nationhood. Mm-hmm. And everyone's nationhood will only function mm-hmm. if it's founded on revolution.
Yeah.
Which, of course, is how America thinks about nationhood.
Yeah.
It has to be founded on revolution.
The Federation planets in the middle, you know, you've got Earth, who've become these hippies, we're led to believe. And I appreciated the way Enterprise deals with that, because when they go back to Earth, people on Earth are still arseholes. And it's the ones who leave Earth, who go off exploring, they're the vegetarian space hippies. But the ones who stay on Earth, they're going, why are you going off poking out there and bringing all this evil stuff back to us? They're very xenophobic, you know, and they attack alien species that are hanging out with the Federation, you know, the Starfleet ones. The Federation doesn't exist yet, but the Starfleet ones, so the Denobulan Doctor, Phlox, and the Vulcans, you know, the Vulcans live in a compound, and T'Pol is quite curious about humans, so she'll put on, you know, a headscarf or something to hide her ears, you know, and try and do her hair so that it'll cover her eyebrows a bit, and she'll go off to jazz clubs and things and be a bit curious,
yeah.
you know, testing the waters, and then of course falls in love with a human. So then we get a precedent for Spock's very existence, because we get a human Vulcan hybrid later
on. And on that, there is a point when Tucker and T'Pol, they learn that they've had a daughter, but it was a genetic clone. You know, they've both had tissue samples taken mm-hmm. against their will, and it's been cloned and used by these Earth terrorists to create this thing which is supposed to symbolise the pollution of the mm-hmm. human gene pool by foreign DNA. But the scriptwriters for that episode, they point out that it's not just unlikely. It's basically impossible for a species from this planet and a species from another planet who are not at all related. They're not cousin species at all. It's completely impossible for them to reproduce together. And so this baby that's produced from T'Pol and Tripp's cells doesn't survive.
No, it's yeah. no. They Phlox then later demonstrates that actually it was the combination cloning process that meant that the baby doesn't survive, and that actually it is perfectly possible. And sure, there's that other timeline where they have a son. They have a son naturally together. Do you know? You remember when they're stuck in the expanse, the Delphic expanse, in the third season? They're trying to find the Zindi planets.
Yeah,
they come into this other Enterprise, but it's over 100 years old, and it's captained by their son.
And it's kind of retrofitted.
And T'Pol is still alive.
Yes. Okay.
As a very old woman.
Yeah, I take all of that back. Yeah. No one in Star Trek has ever recognised that it would be impossible for species from two different planets to reproduce.
But that, they set the precedent then.
Yeah.
Because it's one of those where there are these hard roads to go through, where it's an allegory again for mixed race relationships that have had a very hard road to become accepted in society all over the world. So the likes of a Vulcan and a human having a relationship, T'Pol and Trip Tucker have a very difficult time. They have a very traumatic romance, really. But that paves the way for Sarek Jack and Amanda to later be able to marry and have a son who is Spock. I think Enterprise is very important to help us see a lot of that establishment, because again, these are things you take for granted, but they're very hard roads to go through before somebody can have the privileges that that paves the way for.
And just to credit accurately, the "we are the vegetarian space socialists who are always right," that is from a YouTube video by Alistair Beckett King, which is hilarious, including the little detail about how there's no such thing as up in space.
I know.
But Star Trek tends to mean that everyone's agreed that that direction, audio medium, counts as up in space.
If you're enjoying the show and would like more information straight to your inbox, head over to audiovisualcultures.com, linked in the show notes, and sign up to our mailing list.
I think it's time to rate the captains.
Is it?
Are we ready? I'm ready to rate the captains.
This might be a huge debate in itself. Because
There's this big question in Star Trek circles, which is Kirk or Picard? Now, in answer to that particular question, the answer is obviously Picard.
I think for us, it's Picard for sure. No, it's just down.
For anyone with their head screwed on at all, it's Picard. Because Kirk, although there's times when he goes, "Well, I'm in charge, shut up," most of the time, he's just kind of louche and laid back. He's not in control of situations. At moments when he should be doing something to make a difference, he doesn't. He's not a very good captain at all. Picard, he's a diplomat, he's a manager, he's in control of that ship, and he makes decisions, including when he's run out of ideas, going, "Suggestions?" And someone comes up with a suggestion, and he goes, "Right, we're going to do that."
And there's always time for a cup of hot Earl Grey.
Right. Minor pause, yes. Hot drinks in TNG, DS9 and Voyager. Everyone's got a hot drink at some point. And
I think that's probably because, as they establish an Enterprise, they're all drunk half the time.
They have to have something in the hand that isn't a beer.
They're always drinking alcohol.
Yeah.
Because they haven't got synthahol yet. It's alcohol they're drinking. You know, it's whiskey, it's Andorian ale, it's wine. They're just constantly blitzed and then going back to the bridge to deal with the crisis. And I think that's, maybe they've done that to go, "I wonder why they all just started drinking hot drinks, you know, coffee and tea all the time." Yeah. I think that's probably why.
So yeah, Picard, he can claim sole responsibility for the hot drink principle. Right, so Picard better than Kirk. We've established that, right. But we have other captains to insert into this chart.
I have things to say.
All right, I'll just share with you my list of captains. Okay, Picard is the best. Second place.
He might be the best. He's not my favourite. That's what I'm going to say.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's a distinction there.
Just the fact that Picard worked out that in that very early episode that he was being communicated with, but with people whose language didn't have a notion of abstract concepts. Just the fact that he figured that out puts him way above Kirk. Way above Kirk.
Yeah. Right. He's patient. And he doesn't like children. And he had a whole episode where he got stuck with children and he survived. So that alone...
Yes.
The man is a hero. Yeah.
And the episode where he became a child and had to pretend to be childish.
That was fun, right. That one.
So, second place.
He's the most English French man there ever has been.
He once uttered one French word and that was it for the rest of the time.
Did he say merde one time? One of the films, I think he says merde.
Oh, okay. Two French
which
words,
means shit in French.
Right.
It's the only way they could get away with swearing until Discovery. I love how Tilly drops the F-bomb and she stopped doing that. Now she's trying to be she's trying to be a grown-up.
Second place, by a nose, Janeway.
I don't agree with that. I think Janeway puts the Voyager crew in a lot more danger than is necessary.
There is a lot of, let's just go and poke at that. But it's everyone does that.
There's coffee in that nebula. Is there Janeway? Is there not? Really? There isn't death and destruction in that nebula?
Everyone pokes at the nebula, okay? So that's a baseline. She's very good at making decisions. Yeah. She'll go head to head with people. She will take advice. She has what I and my friends at university used to call verbal sex. Not oral sex, but verbal sex with Chakotay.
I know.
They are the couple who can never actually get together because she's captain.
Oh, yeah. They should have been together by the end of that. The thing they did with Seven and Chakotay, it was just not okay. Yeah.
That's dealt with quite well. That because of the whole, "You're captain, you can't have a relationship with this crew member thing." And that's established quite early in TNG.
The whole purpose of the holodeck.
Yeah. That's established quite early in TNG where Picard does have a relationship with one of his crew members.
Yeah.
And then goes... Yeah, and his conclusion about why it shouldn't happen is that he has the ability to order her to her death. And that would really hurt him if he was ordering his own partner to his death. Whereas by Janeway's time, what they've established is you ought not to have a relationship with any of your crew members because of the power relationship involved. It would be an implicit abuse of power to do that, right? Now, of course, what the doctor who talks with her about this does is he goes, well, do stuff on the holodeck.
Yeah.
And the holodeck is an implicit reference to masturbation.
Mm.
The holodeck says it's okay to masturbate. And this is the way that Star Trek just very quietly addresses something that everyone's thinking, but that no one can publicly say for fear of censure.
Yeah.
Yeah, Janeway doesn't. She definitely pokes at stuff.
But she does have a salamander baby, says Paris that time.
Yeah, yeah. So if you get turned into a salamander, then you can shag one of your own crew
members.
Yeah. All right, so Janeway second.
And populate a planet with your salamander babies.
So the other four captains...
I wonder what happened to them.
I'm sure there'll be a spin-off series. The other four captains of which we are aware are Sisko.
Becomes a captain.
He starts as a commander, becomes a captain. Archer.
Yeah.
Pike.
Love Pike. I have a soft spot for Pike, I would
And this
say.
Is not just the Pike of the pilot and one of the later Series 1 episodes for the original series. This is the
Mount as Pike, I think, is fantastic.
This is the Pike of Season 2 of Discovery.
And then we'll continue in Strange New Worlds.
Which we are dying about.
With number one, played by Rebecca Roman, who is reprising the role originated by the Queen of Star Trek, Majel Barrett.
Yes. This is basically, it envisions a future, and it envisions an alternative past, actually, an alternative 1960s, in which the Star Trek that was made was the Star Trek as pitched by the pilot called The Cage.
Mm-hmm.
Where, of course, what happened in reality was that the first pilot called The Cage, with Pike as the captain and a female number one who's never named, that wasn't approved. But Gene Roddenberry was told, go and make another pilot. We're interested in the ideas, but what you just made was way too sedate.
No, they said it was too cerebral.
Yeah, okay. Well,
NBC said it was too cerebral. Yeah.
So he makes another pilot. And
I thought that was great. You know, because the aliens, the Talosians, isn't it? They have these massive pulsing craniums. I thought that effect was great.
Yeah.
For the 1960s, wasn't it? Sort of mid-60s, that was?
Not bad, yeah.
I thought that was class.
So NBC say, no, get them to make another pilot, and that one is picked up. And that's the pilot in which Shatner is Kirk. And the only character who they've kept is Spock. And even Spock gets retooled a bit. His eyebrows get tidied up and he becomes less emotional.
Yeah, it was interesting. It's, because we've seen this explained. It was that Jeffrey Hunter was Pike and he was playing it very deadpan, you know, very straight. Very
captainly.
Yeah, very captainly, very serious. And so Leonard Nimoy thought, well, one has to be up and one has to be down. So he's very expressive as
Spock. He smiles a lot, yeah. So they haven't
smiles, he laughs, he takes joy in things. So they find singing flowers and it makes him laugh. And
the women! There's that bit as well.
The women!
Yeah. Everyone has to watch it for that scene.
But by the time William Shatner's cast, it turns the other way. He's very expressive and dynamic and cheeky, so Leonard Nimoy becomes the serious straight man.
Then later in season one, all of that unused footage for that pilot with Pike and number one with the cage, all of that is reused as part of an episode in which Pike is brought back, but it's a different actor and he's seriously injured and can't even speak. And he's returned to the planet of Talos IV. And so Pike is acknowledged to have existed.
Mm.
And so because of that, what can then happen is that in Discovery, we can have interactions between, which of course is set about 10 years before the original series, we can have interactions between the crew of Discovery and the crew of the Enterprise as commanded by Pike. And for all of season two, Pike becomes acting captain of Discovery. And we meet number one as well, whose name is...
Una.
Which is very good.
Which is a female one in Spanish.
Yeah. At the end of season two, when Discovery is flung to the future, we get a little epilogue in which we see this setup where lots of disruptions to what's happened to the Enterprise. Those are all resolved. And everyone's back on it. Pike's back on it and Spock's back on it and he's been restored.
And the disruption is that because they were using holographic communications and Pike blames that for all the systems failures on the Enterprise. And that's why we end up with view screens because he orders them to all be ripped out.
Yeah. That's why even though we've gone totally spacey with the Starfleet of Discovery, that's why when we get to Enterprise, when we get to, the original series, that's why the tech looks really crap. Yeah. So, but that's setting up for the adventures of the Enterprise as commanded by Pike in the decade or so up to when Kirk takes over as captain. And of course, if the cage had been picked up as the actual first episode of Star Trek, Shatner would never have been in Star Trek, presumably. And we would have a very different sort of Star Trek. And now that's being imagined in Strange New Worlds. Mm-hmm. And someone seems to have gone, in writing for Discovery, we've got a whole bit of story there that no one ever told, which was the adventures of the Pike-commanded Enterprise other than the cage. So yeah, we're all very excited about this, particularly the working within the box of limitations, which is, well, everyone's uniforms have to look like this, but we can change a few things.
You can update design. A bit. They've kept the colours, but they update the look of things.
Yeah. This is how I rate the captains altogether. So, best Captain Picard, second best Janeway, by a nose, third best Sisko. The only reason I think that Sisko isn't quite as good a captain as Janeway is that Sisko has a slightly greater tendency just to go completely bonkers. he gets possessed in one episode and spends the entire episode just making a clock. I don't think Janeway ever at any point gets possessed by something.
Well, there's the killing time, is it? Where they're taken over by the Hirogen and they have those implants
in. Gets programmed.
They get programmed into the holo programs.
You have a better memory than me for relevant things.
I can't sleep at night, so I read all this stuff. I reread it. Plus, I've been listening to the Delta Flyers and they've just done those episodes where they've just looked at that double episode with the Hirogen.
Right.
So it's all fresh for me. I'm reliving it all again through
and,
them.
And Janeway has to deal with a slightly more difficult situation than Sisko, which is that she has to ask, can we even continue to apply Starfleet principles when we're out here?
They should have become space pirates.
Sisko, he has to deal with complex geopolitics, but the Federation is still next door. Right, so after Sisko, Saru. Aww. I think that Saru is a better captain than Pike.
Oh, do you think?
Yeah. Pike seems to be somewhat cavalier.
He is very 1950s.
Yeah. Pike has this really annoying tendency to go on away missions. And let's be clear, what happens when the captain goes on an away mission is the captain gets captured, right? So the captain should never go on an away mission. First officer can lead away missions, that's fine. It's probably best if you don't let the first officer go on away missions either.
You should have a team.
Yeah, because there's been...
Why is it the bridge team that flies the ship?
Yeah, there should be the B shift, whose job it is to go out and fight people. Yeah. So there were several occasions in TNG where an away mission goes out and Picard gets captured and Riker has to go off and find Picard. And so who's left commanding the Enterprise? Well, it's Data as third officer. Yeah. Pike tends to go on away missions. Saru, the one time Saru goes on an away mission, it's because he goes, we're going to talk to a Kelpian and he's probably terrified. He's probably a child. I'm the only Kelpian. He needs to see a friendly face. Yeah. He has a big justification for going on the away mission. He leaves when the Discovery crash lands, when it first arrives in the 32nd century.
Yeah.
He leaves when the ship can't go anywhere, goes to go and make first contact. But that's justified by the fact that the ship has crash landed on the planet. It's not like it could go anywhere. Yeah, Saru sometimes leaves the ship, but mostly, when he's captaining at least, remains on the ship and tells other people to go and do stuff. Whereas Pike is always going on away missions. The very first away mission he leads is one where he comes within a gnat's wing of being killed to go and rescue the crew on the Hiawatha.
Oh, yes.
And people just, they're on these tremendously dangerous, difficult situations. And he comes this close to being killed and he just about gets saved by a combination of Burnham and the two Helms people on Discovery, all working together. And it's later revealed that he's actually he's doing what a captain knows he shouldn't do, which is putting himself in harm's way, because he feels like being excluded from the Klingon Federation war, he wasn't given the opportunity to prove himself. So he keeps trying to prove himself. But that's a flaw.
Yeah, he feels very guilty about it.
All right, so after Pike, Archer. Archer does make some quite stupid decisions.
He doesn't listen to people. He does not listen to T'Pol. She's his second officer. She's initially there as a... She's not part of Starfleet or anything, but she's there as an advisor, and she effectively becomes a science officer and is really the first officer of the whole ship.
Yeah.
And they make that more official. She resigns her commission with the Vulcan
High Command,
later on, because she wants to stay with them and help them with the, is it when they go off for the Zindi stuff?
Yeah.
And she becomes more of a civilian, but she is effectively an honorary member of the crew and Starfleet. So she is effectively the number one. But he never listens to her, and she's much more experienced. She spent time in deep space before on Vulcan ships. She's in her 60s. She's got loads more experience than any of them on this ship. And he does not listen to her ever.
Archer also has this annoying tendency to go on away missions.
Because he has to be the hero every time.
So his life gets put in danger unnecessarily quite
constantly,
a few times.
Constantly.
And then, of course, Kirk, for his many faults, which I don't just include the fact that he's kind of louche and way too casual about everything.
We're not popular with this.
Yeah. It includes the fact that he snogs everyone.
Everyone.
He's very much in favour of this. Well, there's a female crew member there. She might have a rank, you know, we might have to call her lieutenant, whatever. But by all means, you two hook up. I'm fine with losing her as a crew member, as if that's how any of that works.
That's it. It's, oh, Scotty likes her. I'm going to lose an officer. Oh, well. Yeah.
One of the things that makes Kirk a bit crap as a captain is that he is of the 1960s.
I know.
So, yeah, perhaps we could forgive that. you know, put it...
Meet it where it is,
we can,
I guess.
What is it, adjust for...
for meet context, it where it was.
But nonetheless, as the captain of a thing which is supposed to do stuff, of this mostly military vessel, he will just walk into traps. He's much too passive. As a diplomat, he's awful. I mean, he's sometimes good at doing military stuff. There was that episode where they first met the Romulans, which was almost certainly an allusion to one of those Second World War submarine films, where it's a destroyer up against a submarine. I think it's the enemy below. There's quite a few, but it's kind of okay. He's doing lots of, okay, so do this very particular thing. As the captain of this thing, which is metaphorically a military frigate or a battleship, okay. But, you know, as a politician, as a diplomat, as someone who ever just needs to reason with the other people, basically awful. So, Picard, Janeway, Sisko, Saru, Pike, Archer, Kirk. Comments from your listeners may well persuade you that I'm completely wrong.
Sisko's my favourite, I think. I think he has to deal with very different things from the others, because he's not travelling around going poking. He's on this space station with a very tricky diplomatic mission. He's in the middle of a very precarious peace that could disrupt at any moment. I think of him as somebody who is doing a tremendous amount of managing people. He's also a single parent. His wife has been lost at Wolf 359, the Borg attack, which we hear about in The Best of Both Worlds, the episodes you mentioned where Picard becomes the Cusius of the Borg. He has a very strained relationship with Starfleet because of that. You know, it's interesting, even Patrick Stewart is in the pilot of DS9 and hands over. Basically, it's Picard who has to do the handover with Sisko and give him that commission of becoming the commander of Deep Space Nine. And that's very difficult, you know. So from the very get-go, he's already got this strained relationship with Starfleet, and he sees it for what it is. He sees the hypocrisies of this organization that he loves and wants to do well for. So I think the complexities that come with Sisko and what we end up finding out about his own origins.
Oh, yeah. His mum was a wormhole alien.
Yeah.
And a wormhole alien, it sounds, if you don't know about it, it sounds rather tentacly.
Spunkers.
Yeah. But no, a wormhole alien is a non-four-dimensional basically magical beings.
Non-corporeal beings that live in the wormhole, that it's the only stable wormhole that they've found. And it links the Alpha Quadrant with the Gamma Quadrant.
Yeah.
And that's how the Dominion get access, because they're from the Gamma Quadrant. That's how they get access to the Alpha Quadrant. And these are called the Prophets by the Bajorans. They think these are their gods. So there's a whole religion based around these aliens. But it all turns out that his destiny is caught up with these aliens because he's actually of them. You know, he's actually a hybrid.
They went back into something like go back in time and father him so that he would be around at a specific point to save them from these enemy wormhole aliens called Par-Wraiths.
Yeah.
That are kind of these fallen angel figures. I don't think that Sisko, in becoming the emissary of the prophets from the very first two-parter, I don't think in becoming that figure that he becomes a religious nutbag. But he does, very late on in the seventh series, he starts to experience these moments of utter certainty that X and Y are going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't come from messages from the wormhole aliens. He basically just becomes this person of religious conviction. Mm-hmm. And that is deemed by the series at that point to be a good thing.
Setting that stuff aside, because I think that stuff I'm not so sold on. But other than that, I think he proves himself as a captain, a UN as a commander, you know, because he's a commander for the first two or three seasons or something. He gets a promotion, I think, in season four, maybe. I'm not too sure. Around the halfway point, he gets his promotion to captain. I think he shows real leadership in a lot of ways. And he is a leader who is prepared to learn and prepared to listen to his staff.
Yeah.
He always has good advice for people. He's very centered. You know, when the prophet stuff isn't happening, he's very centered, I think.
And I suppose, you know, I might reconsider putting Janeway a bit ahead of Sisko, because both Janeway and Sisko, they have to create crews out of two distinct groups.
Mm-hmm.
Picard doesn't have to do that. Saru doesn't have to do that. Yeah. Pike doesn't have to do that. They've all got Starfleet crews, whereas Janeway's got a Starfleet crew plus a bunch of Marquis. It's not quite clear, mate, how many. It's about 25-ish Marquis.
They're not fully clear on that. We don't meet them all, really. It's just they're designated by the different pips when they take on the Starfleet uniforms. Yeah. I think they do that too early. I think there should have been a couple of episodes of conflict, but then because it's episodic, they just want them in the uniforms as soon as possible, and now we can have adventures as Starfleet, you know. But
let's go play.
But if it was more of a serialized thing, I think they would hold off and they would explore that conflict and that difficulty with assimilation a bit more now.
They did a few later episodes where they did time travel stuff back to when there were conflicts, as if they had gone, you know, we skipped over that too quickly. Right. So yeah, Janeway does have to solder together those two crews, but what she does very quickly is she wins over Chakotay, and then he does that work of soldering them together. Tuvok does it too. So Janeway doesn't do much of that work. So there's a bit of a challenge there. But with Sisko, he has to solder together a Federation, a Starfleet, and a Bajoran crew, including Major Kiran Reese, who initially is quite willing to kick Sisko off the station. She does not want Starfleet to be there helping at all. She wants this to now be a completely Bajoran station.
Yeah, he has a huge amount of work to do to gain trust. But also, I mean, I would say, though, Pike does have work to do to gain trust, because he's taken over from Gabriel Lorca. Hello to Jason Isaacs, who we find out is from... What? I had to do that. It's obligatory.
You couldn't not. Yes.
He's been the captain of Discovery for the first season, but we find out that he's actually from the Mirror Universe, and something pulled him over to the Prime Universe. And
pulled Prime Lorca over to the Mirror Universe.
And he was probably killed immediately because he was being sought out for execution because he was treasonous. So Pike is having to pick up a crew that is full of distrust, and he basically prepares that crew to become the cohesive crew that they become, and they become a family, and Saru leads them, and then we've left Discovery at a point where Michael has been promoted to captain and she's about to lead them as captain, so we can't judge Burnham yet as a captain.
Yeah, that's, I did think, should we put Burnham on the list because she's captain?
Well, we can't speak to that yet, and plus it's quite new because there are only a few episodes in as we record this, and we haven't seen any of those.
She's commanded the Discovery for a bit of one episode when she was first officer and Pike was off doing a thing.
Yeah.
But yeah.
But we've only ever seen her disobeying orders, running off and killing people, causing a war.
Yeah. In one of those things where she just disobeys an order and goes off and does her own mission, leaving Discovery without its first officer for a bit.
Going rogue.
Her logic is, I'm going to ask for forgiveness, not for permission.
Yeah.
Now, within a non-military organization, that's a kind of sometimes applicable principle, but I don't think that really works within the thing that is Starfleet, which is, you know, part military, part science organization.
Yeah, because I think there are ways to show that, like, I'm sure I'm right about this and gain trust, but there is a bit of a hierarchy, because I think this comes up in Voyager quite a bit, where they have to say, look, this isn't a democracy. I'm the captain. I make decisions. So it's actually quite imperialistic. In a way, where it's not put to committee. I mean, they have these committee meetings with the officers, but I feel like, certainly in Voyager, there's only a certain amount of crew, and that number dwindles quite a bit because people die and they don't get replaced very often. They set off with 170 or something. A load of them die. Then they absorb the McKay crew, and then people die, and they absorb a few people here and there.
Yes.
And
they get something like 4 crew members from the other ship that got sucked into the Delta Quadrant a little bit after them, or a little bit before them.
Well before, because they've already travelled quite a bit. I think they've already been in there for 10 years or something.
But it's rare that they get more people after the initial absorption.
So they actually lose quite a lot of people as time goes on. And so there's only 100 and something of them. And you'd think surely they have some sort of system where they could have a vote. They could have a forum and voice opinions, because, you know, all these big decisions keep getting made. There's that one where they find that planet, the 37s, where a bunch of people from 1937 got pulled in by the caretaker's array. Because I don't think we've even mentioned that. Voyager sets off after the McKay ship into the Badlands, and the Badlands is a bit like the Bermuda Triangle of space, and they get pulled across the galaxy.
Something like 70,000 light years away.
From where they were, and it means that it'll take them at least 70 years to get back at the highest warp they can do, which obviously isn't sustainable either. And so they have this prospect of becoming a generational ship. But they're trying to get home, and they're going to go looking for wormholes and other ways, other technologies, because they might find civilizations even more advanced than them and stuff like that. But they come across this planet where there are human inhabitants, and it turns out these people have been, that this caretaker has been pulling stuff for many, many years, you know, many centuries.
Do you know what? I'm thinking it wasn't the caretaker who got the 37s. I think they were abducted.
Oh, and taken?
On a flying saucer and taken by someone
were they?
Else.
So they actually were alien abductees. Yeah. I can't remember. Yeah. It's from the first season. Yeah. No, I think it's the second season opener, but it was made to be part of the first season. It was one of those, because the first season was cut short. So there were episodes that were actually produced for that season, but they were put in the second season.
Yeah.
That was one of them, the 37s. So they have Amelia Earhart. That's how they suggest that her disappearance was, that she was scooped off under this other planet. Yeah. And so some of them have been cryogenically frozen. So she's one of these people who's cryogenically frozen. So she's been in preservation all this time, and they wake her up, and then she's alive again. And there's this whole civilization of humans descended from these people from 1937. And there's this option for the crew, if anybody wants to just settle somewhere, because there's this human civilization, they can do that. And none of them volunteer to do that. None of them volunteer to stay. They all go off back onto Voyager.
There's a scene in that episode where Janeway says, whoever wants to stay on this planet, report to the Cargo Bay 2 at this particular time. There's a walk and talk scene with her and Chakotay going down there to see who's turned up. And she opens the door and there's no one there.
Mm-hmm.
When I saw that, I just thought it would be the funniest thing to have one person, say, poke her head out from between two piles of big, dangerous boxes or something, and just go, yes, Captain, what can I do for you? I was just doing a stock take. What are you doing in Cargo Bay 2? Okay, so then that scene I think is quite important, because she says to the crew, I'm giving you a choice.
Yeah.
And they make a choice, and that's about it for the crew making choices at any point.
Yeah, but they never get the option ever again to go, would anybody like to settle here? Because there's ones where Harry has terrible luck with love in this series, and he never gets promoted, and he's never done proven himself, and he's just an ensign for 7 years, that wee fella. It's not on.
Always the bridesmaid.
He's never done saving them all. Yeah. And he has all this terrible luck with relationships. But there is one where he and another alien, they really properly fall in love and they have a really lovely, fun relationship. But, you know, her culture won't really allow her, permit her. And it's terribly heartbreaking, and it's worse because her species, they really combine with each other, and it's an even deeper heartbreak when they're pulled apart from each other. And it just feels like he should have really had the option to stay with her, maybe. But
that early episode with the 37s, I think it's quite symbolic for the whole of the series that is Voyager. Because in a situation where it might seem reasonable to give people a choice sometimes, they go through the motion of giving everyone a choice not to make a choice.
Yeah.
And that's one of the fundamental elements of democracy, is that you say to everyone, every 4 years or so, you say, right, now we're giving you the choice for the duration of the whole of the next parliamentary term or whatever. We're giving you the choice to not make a choice. So as long as you have that choice-making ritual once every 4 years, you've now agreed that you're not going to be the one who makes any of the choices during the next four-year period. And that seems to be what they do in the 37s, in the episode of Voyager. So, and it is called the 37s, isn't it, the episode?
Yeah.
Where it's just a matter of going, we're going to acknowledge that our situation is somewhat dictatorial, but it's fine because it's underpinned by the choice by the electorate not to make any choices. And that is actually quite common to all of the Star Trek series, that they're going, right, we're really big on democracy, but this particular organization isn't one. This organization, Starfleet, that works for the big democratic organization that is Federation, it isn't one. And it's dictatorial, and that has to be fine with everyone because this is how we keep the Federation intact. And so it's constantly a commentary on what one has to do to uphold democracy, which is have these organizations at the barricades that are non-democratic organizations protecting civilians. So inevitably, as you're playing out that internal negotiation of how reasonable that situation is, you're going to have situations where a lieutenant comes into conflict with a commander about the commander's decision, or the entire crew comes into conflict with the captain about a captain's decision. There's a very early episode of TNG where Picard is kidnapped and is replaced with this clone.
Oh, yeah.
And the clone gets the crew to just fly closer and closer and closer to a star, such that the radiations get to a point where it's going to kill everyone. And the question is that the clone wants to find out is, the alien wants to find out is, if they know their captain is doing the wrong thing, will they mutiny? And in any other situation, the answer's no, because Picard can be trusted even when he definitely appears outwardly to be doing the wrong thing. He can be trusted to actually do the right thing. But on that particular occasion, no, they do mutiny and that's it. And there's a resistance to a dictatorial authority when it doesn't earn that trust there.
There's that one where Riker has had to, or didn't mutiny with the crew of the Pegasus with his previous captain.
And he regrets it, doesn't he?
And he regretted it because they were right and the captain was wrong.
Isn't it that they don't mutiny, but they just refuse to follow any orders?
I think so. I think they disagree so fundamentally with what he's ordering them to do.
And doesn't the captain stick them on a shuttlecraft or something? We're going to have to go back and rewatch that.
It's that one. It's that one where that awful last episode of Enterprise. It's the one they intersect that with.
They have it so that it's a bunch of holo recordings that Riker's watching. On his way,
so much better than that. Yeah,
to go and investigate the Pegasus, and he knows what happened to it.
Yeah. Troy is trying to help counsel him through this decision to tell Picard. You know, he's watching this holo program of the last days of the original Enterprise as sort of inspiration, and it's quite morbid, actually.
Yeah.
It's really weird, and they make it into a game, which I think, in a way, opens it up to be totally retconned, because if that's a holo program that's 200 years later, fine, you can retcon that. The actors have all aged, of course, but they could do voice stuff. They could do animation or audio series. I mean, that would be so great for them to do their last three seasons in audio format or animated format. Would be brilliant.
That was something where your and my appetites had been thoroughly whetted.
Yeah.
For the culminating founding of the Federation.
Yes.
That would culminate Enterprise. And they kept doing call forwards to it by having, what was his name? The time traveler from Whale from the Future, who would come back and say to Archer, mm-hmm. right, someone's messing with the timeline.
Yeah.
I need you to fix these things. There's this temporal Cold War going on. And people keep changing it so that the Federation doesn't get founded. Mm. And it's becoming very clear that you're really instrumental.
He is the founder, really, of it.
And of course, it becomes clear as Archer does his thing that he stops the Andorians and the Vulcans fighting. So, there's some smoothing over of relations there.
Yeah.
Now we're friends. He stops the Andorians and the Tellarites fighting. Mm. There's some smoothing over of relations. So, there's this incremental moving towards... They're going to found the Federation. They're going to do this. And then towards the end of season four, there's the beginning of these negotiations to sign this treaty, which might be one of the first proto-documents of the Federation. It's not the Federation yet. And then right at the end of season four, Archer's then drags forwards in time one more time by this time traveler to go, you've basically done everything you're going to do in getting the Federation to happen. This is going to happen in 3 years. Look, it's you at a big ceremony founding the Federation. Mm. Well done. And you and I felt thoroughly robbed of our story arc leading up to the founding of the Federation.
Because there's supposed to be the war with the Romulans as well, isn't there, before then? Isn't there? There's a big war that's meant to happen, and that's partly how they all come together.
You're making me wish I was an insomniac now, and that I could look this stuff up in the night.
Because I could. Yeah.
I haven't...
I know.
Maybe.
It's something to do with that. Because in TNG, the first time the Romulans are in it, nobody's seen the Romulans for 100 years. Mm. And there's that appearance they have in original series. And there is a brush with them in Enterprise, but they're never seen because it's audio only.
Yeah.
And they have to deal with one of their minds that gets left on. That's that thing that digs into Reed's leg.
And also a remotely piloted ship.
Yeah.
In another episode.
So there's just little brushings with them. So they are out there, but they're very insular. But I think there's supposed to be some sort of big war that happens. Yeah. And then the Federation is partly founded out of that coalition that come together as allies to defend themselves. And then the Federation is built on those four planets that come together. It's something like that. That was supposed to all happen. That was supposed to be what would have happened in the last three seasons. But they never got to get made.
Now, we ought to acknowledge, since you and I have gone, right, TNG, DS9, Voyager, blah, 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 and then we've gone, we better go back and watch somebody finally bite the bullet and watch the original series, that for about the first 8 or 9 episodes of the original series, it's not Star Trek.
Yeah.
As we'd recognise it, even though it's had its second pilot, which has got Shatner in it, it's become rebooted as this thing in which they all kind of look recognisable. For the first few episodes, the uniforms aren't the right colour. They keep calling their weapons lasers rather than phasers. The thing they work for isn't called Starfleet. I think at one point it's called the United Earth Space Probe Agency. Mm. And there's a callback to that much later on. I think in Star Trek The Motion Picture there's a callback to that. No, hang on. No, there's The Voyage Home. There's an allusion to it.
Okay.
And it's kind of like in the corner of a shot at one point. Anyway. The thing that they represent isn't called the Federation. Mm. Early on, it's called the United Earth. So there is some sense that there's no such thing as nations left on Earth.
Yeah,
but the idea of a Federation hasn't come about yet. It really takes until about the beginning of season 2 of the original series for Star Trek as we would recognise it. The thing that's constantly being paid homage to by TNG and all the way up to Discovery, for that to come about. For the whole, we are the Federation, we're not going to sacrifice our Federation principles. That just doesn't exist from almost the whole of the first season of the original series.
And United Earth is really very brand new in Enterprise. This is really something that's happened in the last few years for them. Something that is quite integral to Enterprise is what's established in the film First Contact. Zefram Cochrane developing warp capability.
Yeah, First Contact... It's name-checked again and again and again and again in Enterprise as this fundamental event, including in the Mirror Universe as well.
It establishes the whole of the Mirror Universe. So we've seen loads of Mirror Universe stuff up until that point. But what happens in Enterprise, and it isn't a case of they get flung over to it or anything, it just shows us that same crew in the Mirror Universe. And the credits change, they go dark. the theme tune's removed, which was a blessing. But it goes back and it uses footage from the film and redoes it. It has them as Saffron Cochrane rather than shaking hands with the Vulcans who come to visit. He attacks them and they overrun their ship and steal their technology.
Yeah.
And so then it just goes through this alternate history. And that is the changing point. So all of human history until then is basically the same, but they lean into that war side of them. And this happens in something like about 2066.
After a third world war.
After a third world war. Yeah. You know, so in the Prime Universe, this leads to the emergence of the what would become a united Earth. So Enterprise starts in 2151 and they operate under the United Earth, whatever, the United Earth Starfleet or whatever it is, but it's quite new.
The first few episodes of Enterprise make it clear that during that century, between the Zefram Cochrane encounter, between first contact with the Vulcans and the beginning of Enterprise, the Vulcans have been helping, but also doing a whole lot of going, no, we're not going to give you that technology. Mm-hmm. We have to see whether you're ready for it yet. Mm-hmm. So I've been doing quite a lot of sitting back and going,
observe and see what they develop by themselves. And I think that relates to, they lean into this a bit more as well, I think, in Discovery quite subtly with Spock, because it turns out that Michael Burnham is the adopted sister of Spock. Her parents are killed and she is raised by Sarek and Amanda, Spock's parents. And so she is raised as the older sister of Spock, and then they do the whole arc that ends up explaining why he has never mentioned her. Her existence is classified and all of this. But with Spock, they establish in the debriefs that happen after Discovery has been flung off to the future, the ones who are left behind, so Pike and Spock, they have to be debriefed on what happened. And Spock talks about what will become familiar to us as the Prime Directive, where they shouldn't interfere with pre-warp civilizations. Shouldn't go poking, basically. Stop going poking at things before people are ready. If they can't come up to space to meet us, we don't go down and bother them. None of this alien abduction stuff, lads. So that's why the Vulcans before him hang back and they don't get involved. And the humans see this with resentment because they think, well, you could have just given us this. You could have just helped us. But the Vulcans are very measured and they say, no, we need to see you develop this for yourselves and build the maturity for yourselves and show us that you can be out there in the galaxy. It's not what you think it is. And then it turns out, to an extent, they're right. I mean, it feels like overbearing parenting.
And the antagonism between humans and Vulcans in Enterprise is new because this constant refrain all the way from the original series through First Contact up to the end of Voyager, this constant refrain is that humans and Vulcans are bros. They are the initial making friends with people from another planet that meant that the Federation could happen. Whereas, you know, Enterprise, this antagonism is quite new.
Yeah, but it shows again that idea that it's a hard road to get to that level of trust.
It's been a long road.
Exactly. That's why it's actually quite fitting.
Getting from there to here.
Anyway, so...
geopolitics. Conflict.
I liked how they did that, how they wrote the what we see in First Contact as the origin for how the Terran Empire rises in the Mirror Universe. I think that was really clever, and I would have... it's my favourite thing about the whole thing, I think, is the Mirror Universe. And I'd love to have seen how they would have developed that more in later series, because Empress Hoshi would have rocked my world, I'm pretty sure.
Yes.
And I think that she's how we get Georgiou as the Emperor.
So let's be clear that what happens at the end of the Mirror Universe two-parter of Enterprise is that the Enterprise crew get hold of a starship that's been flung there from the Prime Universe, from the future of the Prime Universe, and it's the Defiant.
And this is in the original series. We haven't got to this yet, but we are going to get to it. And they've done something with something that happened in the original series. Yeah. The ship just disappears.
And so it's the original series Defiant, which is a starship like the Enterprise, not the Deep Space Nine Defiant. The Enterprise crew in Enterprise Dark Universe one, sorry, Mirror Universe one, they get hold of this starship that's much, much better than anything that anyone on Earth has got. And Archer takes it to Earth, planning to take over as Emperor. Mm. And right at the last minute, Hoshi Sato kills him.
She's been playing the long game.
And she takes over as Emperor. And that's it. It's over and end
that's
of that.
That's all we see, yeah.
And we'll get back to the Prime Universe.
Yeah.
It is a fantastic way, the whole Mirror Universe thing. And we haven't seen the original series founding of the Mirror Universe episode yet, but we will. The whole Mirror Universe thing goes... The way that the Federation iterates Earth's relationship with other planets is definitely good. Even though it's vegetarian space socialism, even though it's the United Nations, even though it's having to work together, the alternative, which is a human empire, human space empire, is hell.
And it's basically if all humans were psychopaths, if all humans had no capacity for empathy and were all murderous traitors.
And it's not just hell for people outside the empire and people who are enslaved by it. It's hell for the humans because everyone's constantly having to fear for their life.
Yeah, you don't know who's going to kill you.
Yeah. What would they do with the Emperor Georgiou character in Discovery is great because they have her go to the Prime Universe, learn a few things, and then go back in a... I know it's just in a vision, but, you know, she goes back to the Mirror Universe.
And we don't know where she's been sent to when she goes through the
portal.
The portal.
Which is guarded by the Guardian of Forever. And that feels a bit like a setup for a spin-off series, doesn't it?
Well done if you made it to the end of all that. It may not come as a shock, but there is another hour-long recording that is going to release for our BuyPAT patrons and above next week. So you don't miss that or other such bonus content, sign up at the BuyPAT tier for £2.50 a month if you're in the UK or equivalent if you're elsewhere at patreon.com/AVCultures. There's also about 10 minutes of outtakes available to our behind-the-scenes supporters for £5 a month. And for that, you get access to outtakes reels and, when we have them, the full video recordings of episodes. All of that, again, is via patreon.com/AVCultures. Please do take a look. These regular payments have been helping me to gradually upgrade my equipment, which has led to noticeable improvements in the sound quality and recording capabilities for the podcast. My patrons' cumulative funds have also paid for an upgrade to the podcast's website and domain, which is now at audiovisualcultures.com. So if you can, I would so appreciate you joining the team. I really would like to think of my patrons as a bit like my board of trustees or something. I always run stuff past everybody before I make decisions, so it'd be great to have you on board. And if you can't help out financially but you really want to do something, please do share the podcast with people you know. I really, really appreciate people doing this. Some people out there are doing it and I notice it and I love it and I'm so, so grateful, and it really is a massive help because I think the people in our lives really take notice of our recommendations. So if you tell a friend, I think you'd really get something out of listening to this, they might actually listen, and that would be a huge help for us. So I'd love it if you could do that. So well done for getting through this again, and I will catch you next time. Thank you for tuning in to this Cozy Pea Pod production. If you got something out of this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you could give us a good rating wherever you're accessing it and share it with someone you know will find it really interesting. If early releases and bonus content sound appealing, visit patreon.com/AVCultures and join one of our support tiers. If you want to help the show but can't manage a membership, we'd love you to join the conversation with AV Cultures Pod on Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter. The music is Common Ground by Airtone, used under a 3.0 Creative Commons non-commercial license, and is available at ccmixter.org. I've been Paula Blair, and you've been a fantastic audience. Mind yourselves, until next time.